The blonde man grins and points at them with the metal pipe. Chapter 58. Yuna stands still with his arms wrapped round him, leaning forward slightly. He sees the blonde man change his grip on the pipe and move to the side. The bald man takes off his jacket and hangs it over a plastic chair. Yuna slowly raises his head and looks the bald man in the eyes. "Give the money back to Krina," he repeats. The bald man grins with surprise and steps sideways into the darkness. There's a click as he unfolds the blade of a flick knife. "I'm going to hurt you if you don't drop the knife on the ground now," Yuna says in his melancholic Finnish accent, and takes a step forward. The bald man crouches down and moves aside, holding the knife in a classic hammer grip, then reaches forward and takes a few trial stabs.
"Be careful,"
Yuna says, and coughs gently. The knife is sharp and glimmers in the weak light. Yuna watches it with his eyes and tries to read the man's irregular movements.
"Do you want to die?"
the man grunts.
"I may look slow," Yuna says, "but I'm going to take that knife and break your arm at the elbow. And if you don't lie still after that, I'll puncture your right lung."
"Stab the fin," the blonde man shouts. "Stab the fucking fin."
"And I'll deal with you next, once I've got the knife," Yuna says, stumbling into a rusty bicycle.
The bald man swings the knife to the side unexpectedly, and the blade catches Yuna across the back of his hand, which starts to bleed. The blonde man backs away with a forced smile. Yuna wipes the blood from his hand on his trousers. The bald man shouts something to the blonde one. A baby starts crying in one of the caravans. The blonde man moves in behind Yuna's back. He notices, but is too weak to move. When Yuna glances over his shoulder, the bald man mounts an attack. He aims low towards Yuna's kidneys. The white blade jabs forward like a lizard's tongue. It happens fast, but everything is still there as a physical memory. Yuna doesn't think as he deflects the knife, grabs the man's hand, and closes his fingers over his cold knuckles. Everything happens in rapid succession. Yuna bends the man's wrist, puts his other hand under his elbow, and jerks upward. When the man's arm breaks, there's a cracking sound like standing on a twig beneath deep snow. Splinters of the radial bone pierce through ligaments and tissue, and a squirt of blood spatters a filthy bucket. The man sinks to his knees, screaming, and bends double on the ground.
"Behind you!"
Eric shouts. Yuna turns. Suddenly giddy, he stumbles in a pool of water, stares up at the tops of the pines against the sky, but manages to keep his balance. He spins the knife between his fingers, changes his grip, and hides it behind his body as he approaches the blonde man.
"Leave me the fuck alone!"
the man shouts and swipes at the air with the pipe. Yuna goes straight in, takes the next blow on his shoulder, cuts the man across the forehead, and rams his lower arm up into the man's armpit, knocking his arm out of its socket as the pipe falls to the ground. The blonde man gasps as he clutches the top of his arm, moves backwards, but can't see anything for the blood running into his eyes. He stumbles over a pile of wood and remains there, lying on his back. The man with the saucepan has disappeared into the darkness behind the camp. Yuna walks over, leans down, and takes the money from both men, panting as he does so. He knocks on the door of the caravan, leaning against the frame to stop himself falling. Eric runs over and holds him up when he staggers.
"Give the money to Krina,"
Yuna says, and sits down on the step. Eric opens the caravan door, sees the woman in the gloom at the far end, looks her in the eye, and shows her where he hides the money under her carpet. Yuna slips down onto the grass, with his head resting against one of the concrete blocks holding the caravan up. The tattooed man comes back round the first caravan. He's holding a shotgun and is approaching with long strides. Eric realizes that Yuna is in no condition to run, so crawls beneath the caravan and tries to pull him in behind him. "Try to help," he whispers. Yuna kicks his legs and slowly slides in. The grit catches his jacket and they can hear steps nearby. They hear the man with the gun open the caravan door and shout at the old woman. The floor above them thunders as he goes inside. "Come on," Eric says, crawling further in. He hits his head on a cable tray. Yuna shuffles after him but catches his jacket on a strut. Eric emerges on the other side of the caravan and hides among some nettles. Beneath the caravan, Yuna watches as the tattooed man steps down onto the ground again. They hear voices, and suddenly the man bends down, puts his hands on the ground, and stares right at Yuna as he lies under the caravan.
"Get them!" the blonde man shouts.
Yuna tries to pull himself free, and the seams of his jacket creak. The tattooed man starts to walk round the caravan through the rough undergrowth. Eric slips hurriedly underneath again, crawls over to Yuna, and frees his jacket. They roll sideways, crawl between the concrete blocks, and emerge into the weeds, toss aside a rusty sheet of tin, and take cover beside a shack. The tattooed man comes round the caravan, slips on the wet ground, raises his gun, and takes aim. Eric pulls Yuna out of his line of fire. The man follows them with his gun raised. They crouch down beside a kitchen sink mounted between two trees. The gun goes off, and a stack of crockery on the draining board explodes. Broken shards rain down on them. They're shouting, and voices echo through the trees now. Eric leads Yuna in behind the shack. The tattooed man follows them, the broken crockery crunching beneath his feet. The gun sighs as he expels the cartridge and feeds in a new one. Eric can feel his legs shaking as he pulls Yuna after him into the forest. They hurry across the uneven ground, pushing through tight thickets of pine scrub and getting caught on branches. Yuna's back is wet with sweat. His hip is burning and he's lost all feeling in one foot. He can't focus properly and fever is rolling through him in waves, rushing icily through his veins and making him shiver with cold. Eric is holding him firmly by the arm as they move through the edge of the woods towards the car. Between the trees, they can see the flickering light of pocket torches and a dozen migrants arguing after they disarm the tattooed man with a gun. Yuna has to rest for a while before he and Eric cross the road to the car. His legs give out and he all but falls into the passenger seat and closes his eyes, coughing so badly that it makes his lungs burn. Eric runs round the car, gets in, and locks the doors as there's a sudden thud on the windscreen. The blonde man with the blood-smeared face is lit up by the headlights. He's holding a heavy branch and raises it again as Eric starts the engine and puts his foot down. The front wheel spins on the verge, and grit and small stones fly up beneath the car. There's another crash, and the wing mirror comes loose and dangles from its wires as they lurch back onto the road. They can already hear the sound of emergency vehicles beyond the patch of woodland. Chapter 59. Eric took a double dose of pills that night to get to sleep, but still wakes early and gets up at first light. He thought he had hung a blue shirt over the back of the chair the night before in advance of his trip to Karsudan, but now he can't find it and has to get another one from his wardrobe. The three new murders are reminiscent of the old one, but Rocky has been locked up the whole time, and the police believe he had a partner, a disciple, who for some reason has become active again. Eric has been asked to find out what Rocky remembers and ask him about the unclean preacher. Yuna is still asleep in the guest room when he leaves the house, performs a makeshift repair on the wing mirror with some duct tape, and drives away. As Eric overtakes a horse box, he thinks about how he helped Yuna take his clothes off, got him into the shower, then put him to bed in the guest room. The towel ended up covered in blood as he cleaned the knife wound to the Finn's hand and taped the edges of the cut together. Yuna was awake the whole time, looking at him calmly. Eric gave him an intramuscular tetanus injection, some more penicillin intravenously, got him to drink a glass of water, and then examined the injury to his hip. The old wound had caused a lot of internal bleeding, which had run down into his leg beneath the skin. Nothing was broken. Eric injected some cortisone into the muscle just above his hip and tucked him in. On his way back from Karsuden Hospital, he needs to stop at a chemist and pick up some topiramate for Yuna's migraines. The roads are quiet, and it's still early in the morning as he drives past Katrineholm and approaches the large institution. Kasilas is standing on the steps outside reception, tapping his pipe against the railing. He holds out his hand to greet Eric as he approaches along the path.
"We've conducted numerous neurological examinations," he explains as they head towards the gloomy brick buildings. "This isn't my area, but the experts have ruled out surgery. They say the damage to his brain tissue is permanent. He can function, but he just has to accept the blackouts and erratic memory."
After checking in to Section D4, they are met by a female member of staff with laughter lines around her eyes. "Rocky Shirkland is waiting for you in the calm room," she says, shaking hands with Eric. Regardless of the outcome of this meeting, Eric will tell Margot about the unclean preacher, the man Rocky tried to blame 9 years ago. They stop, and Kasilas explains to the guard that she should wait outside the calm room and then escort Eric to the exit when he's finished. Eric pushes the bead curtain aside and goes in. Rocky is sitting in the middle of one of the sofas with his arms stretched out along the back of it as if he's been crucified. There's a mug of coffee and a cinnamon bun on the low table in front of him. Gentle classical music is streaming from two loudspeakers. Rocky scratches the back of his head against the wall, then looks at Eric with a completely relaxed expression.
"No cigarettes today," he says after a while.
"I can arrange that," Eric replies.
"Get me a pack of Mogadon instead," Rocky says, tucking his hair behind his ears.
"Mogadon?"
"Then Jesus will forgive you your sins."
"I can have a word with your doctor
if you're on Mogadon," Rocky interrupts. "Or is it Rohypnol?"
Eric reaches into his inside pocket and gives him a whole blister pack. Rocky presses one pill out and swallows it without drinking anything.
"Last time I was here, I asked you about someone, a colleague of yours," Eric says, sitting down in an armchair.
"I don't have any colleagues," Rocky says darkly, "because God lost me somewhere along the way and didn't come back to look for me."
He moves his white plastic mug and picks up a piece of pearl sugar on his index finger.
"Do you have any memory of having an accomplice in the murder?"
"Why are you asking?" Rocky wonders.
"We talked about it last time."
"Did I say I had an accomplice?"
"Yes." Eric lies.
Rocky closes his eyes and nods slowly to himself.
"You know, I can't trust my memory," he says,
and opens his eyes again.
I can wake up in the middle of the night and remember a day 20 years ago and write it all down. Then, when I read what I wrote a week later, it feels like I made it all up, like it never happened. And, of course, I don't really know. It's the same thing with my short-term memory. Half the days disappear. I take my medicine, play billiards, talk to some idiots, eat lunch, then it's all gone.
But you haven't said if you had an accomplice when you murdered Rebecca.
I don't give a damn about that. You tell me you were here, but I've never met you before.
I think you remember that I was here.
Do you?
And I think you lie sometimes, Eric says.
Are you saying I tell lies?
Just now you referred to the cigarettes I gave you last time.
I wanted to see if you were keeping up,
Rocky says with a smile. So, what do you remember?
Why should I tell you?
He asks, taking a sip of coffee, then licking his lips. Your accomplice has started murdering on his own.
Serves you right in that case,
Rocky mutters, and suddenly starts to shake. The mug falls from his hand, spilling the last of the coffee across the floor, and his chin trembles. His eyes roll backwards, his eyelids close and twitch. The epileptic attack lasts just a few seconds. Then he straightens up, wipes his mouth, and looks up, apparently unaware of what just happened. You told me before about a preacher, Eric says.
I was alone when I murdered Rebecca Hanson,
Rocky says in a low voice. So, who's the unclean preacher?
What difference does it make?
Just tell me the truth.
What do I get out of it?
What do you want?
I want pure heroin,
Rocky says, and looks Eric in the eye. You can get permission to go out, if you help, Eric says.
I don't remember, anyway. It's all gone. This is pointless.
Eric leans forward in the soft armchair. I can help you remember, he says, after a pause.
No one can help me.
Not in a neurological sense, but I can help you remember what happened.
How?
He asks. I can hypnotize you. Rocky sits still, leaning his head back against the wall. His eyes are half closed and his mouth slightly pursed. There's nothing to be concerned about. Hypnosis is merely a way of accessing another level of consciousness by being in a deep state of relaxation.
I read the journal Cortex, and I remember a long article about neuropsychology and hypnosis,
Rocky says, waving his hand. Chapter 60. They have moved to Rocky's room with the door closed and the lighting turned down. The weak lamplight is reflecting off a Playboy calendar. Eric has set up his tripod, attached the video camera, and adjusted the angle and exposure, and has made sure the microphone is pointing in the right direction. A small red dot indicates that the camera is recording. Schirklund is sitting on a chair. His broad shoulders are relaxed, rounded like a bear's. His head is drooping. He slid into deep relaxation very quickly and responded well to the induction. The difficult part isn't the act of hypnosis, but finding the right level and placing the patient in a state where the brain is as relaxed as possible, yet still able to distinguish between real memories and dreams. Eric is standing just behind Rocky, slowly counting backwards as he prepares Rocky to examine his memories. 212, Eric says in a monotone. 211. You will soon find yourself standing outside Rebecca Hanson's house. When a patient is placed in deep hypnosis, the hypnotist often enters a sort of trance as well, in what is known as hypnotic resonance. It's vital that Eric manages to differentiate between his absolutely present self and a clearly observing self. The observing self, in his own personal trance, is always underwater. That's become his internal image of hypnotic immersion. While his patients are led through their memories, Eric sinks into a warm sea, past steep cliffs and coral. In this way, Eric can remain utterly present in the patient's experience, yet still maintain a protective distance.
88, 87, 86, Eric goes on in a somnolent voice. The only thing that exists is my voice and your desire to listen to it. With each number, you're sinking deeper and deeper into relaxation. 85, 84. There's nothing dangerous here. Nothing to be worried about.
As Eric counts down, he sinks through strangely pink water together with Rocky Sherklund. They're following the chain of an anchor. The rusty links are covered in stringy algae. Above them, on the silvery surface, is the hull of a large ship with motionless propellers. They drift lower. Rocky's eyes are closed, and small air bubbles are rising from his beard. He's got arms by his sides, but the water passing them makes his clothes sway.
51. 50. 49.
Out of the violet darkness sticks the top of a vast underwater mountain, grey-black, like a heap of ash. Rocky raises his face and tries to look, but only the whites of his eyes are visible. His mouth opens and his eyes close again. His hair is drifting above his head as bubbles emerge from his nostrils.
11. 10. 9. You will be able to remember all your real memories of Rebecca Hanson when I say so.
As Eric sinks through the water, simultaneously he observes Rocky on the chair in his room. A string of saliva is hanging from his mouth, and the seams of his white vest are coming loose under his arms.
3, 2, 1. Now you open your eyes and can see Rebecca Hanson the way she was when you last saw her.
Rocky is standing in front of him, on top of the underwater mountain, his clothes moving in the gentle current, his hair floating like slow flames above his head. He opens his mouth, and large bubbles stream out and float up in front of his face.
"Tell me what you can see," Eric says calmly.
"I see her. I'm standing in the garden at the back of the house. Through the terrace door, I see her sitting on the sofa, watching television. Her knitting needles are moving, and a ball of blue wool is slowly unraveling beside her hip. She's said she doesn't want to see me, but I think she'll open her legs anyway."
"What's happening?"
"I knock on the glass door. She takes her glasses off and lets me in. She says she has to go to bed because she's working in the morning, but that I can stay the night if I like."
Eric doesn't interrupt, just waits for the next segment of memories, waits for the images to join up.
"I sit down on the sofa and touch her necklace. There's an old knitting pattern in a women's magazine on the floor. Rebecca puts her knitting down on the table, and I slip a hand between her thighs.
She pulls away, says she doesn't want to, but I pull her nightdress up again. Rocky is breathing heavily. She resists, but I know she's changed her mind. I can see it in her eyes. She wants this now. I kiss her and put my hand between her legs.
He's smiling to himself on the chair, then turns serious.
She says we should go to her bedroom, and I put a finger in her mouth, and she sucks it. And outside.
Rocky stops himself and just stares, his eyes wide open.
There's someone outside. I can see a face. There's someone at the window.
Outside the house? Eric asks.
It was a face. I go over to the glass door, but I can't see anything. Just darkness, and the room reflected in the glass. And then I see someone standing behind me. I spin round, ready to lash out, but it's only Rebecca. She gets scared and tells me to leave. She means it. So I go into the hall and take all the money she's got in her bag, and...
He falls silent, breathing more heavily, and the energy in the room changes, slowly becomes more dangerous. Rocky, I want you to stay with Rebecca, Eric says. It's the same evening. You're at home with her, and...
I've gone to the zone,
Rocky interrupts in a slurred voice. Later that evening, you mean?
I ignore the strippers on the main stage,
he whispers.
I ignore the dealers, because what I'm looking for...
Do you go back to Rebecca's?
No. We sit in the disabled toilet so we can be alone.
Who are you talking about?
My girlfriend, the woman I love. Tina, who... She gives me a blowjob without a condom. She doesn't care. She's in a hurry now. She's sweating all over.
Eric wonders if he ought to bring the patient out of hypnosis. He can feel Rocky moving too quickly through his memories, and no longer knows if it's possible to keep him at the right level.
Tina coughs over the basin and looks at me in the mirror with fear in her eyes. I know she's in a bad way, but
is Tina your accomplice? Eric asks, looking at Rocky's open face.
For fuck's sake, they owe me 100,000. I'll be getting it next week, he mutters. But right now, I can only afford shitty brown shoe scrapings. Have to dissolve it in acid so I can shoot up.
Rocky starts to shake his head anxiously and is breathing unevenly through his nose. There's no danger here, Eric says, as calmly as he can. You're quite safe. You can talk about everything that happens. Rocky's body relaxes again, but his face is lined and sweaty.
I sit there. Let her have the spoon. I'm not getting a kick anymore, but I feel great and start to nod off. And I see her use a cable as a tourniquet around her arm. The adapter's whirring and getting all tangled, and she can't sort it out afterwards. I'm too out of it to help her. I hear her ask for help with a sob in her voice.
Rocky whimpers slightly, and the atmosphere seems to contract to a single dark pinprick. What's happening now? Eric asks.
The door opens, Rocky replies. Some bastard has picked the lock. I shut my eyes. I've got to rest. But I know it's the preacher. The preacher's found me.
How do you know that?
I can tell because of the filthy smell of old gear. It's withdrawal. It smells metallic, like fish guts.
Rocky shakes his head again. His breathing is getting too quick. and Eric thinks he should start to bring Rocky out of his hypnosis, but holds back. "What's happening?" he whispers.
"I open my eyes, and the preacher looks a fucking wreck," he says. "Hepatitis, probably. Completely yellow eyes." The preacher snorts back some snot, then starts to speak in a really high voice.
Rocky is breathing shallowly, twisting on his chair and moaning in anguish between his words.
The preacher goes over to Tina. She's shot up, but can't get the cable loose. "Dear God in heaven, have mercy on my soul, dear God in heaven."
"Rocky, I'm going to start to wake you up."
"And the preacher's holding a machete, and it sounds like when you stick a spade into mud."
Rocky starts to retch. He's panting heavily now, but goes on talking.
"The preacher chops her arm off at the shoulder, loosens the tourniquet, and drinks."
"Listen to my voice now."
"And drinks the blood from her arm, while Tina lies bleeding to death on the floor. Dear God in heaven, dear God."
3, 2, 1. Now you're above the disabled toilet. You're high above it, and nothing you can see is going to hurt you.
"Dear God,"
Rocky sobs, hanging his head. "You're still in a state of deep relaxation, and you're going to tell me how much of what you've just said to me was a dream. You've taken drugs and have been having nightmares. You're looking down at yourself on the toilet floor. What's really going on?"
"I don't know,"
Rocky says slowly. "Who is he?"
"The preacher's face is covered in blood. Shows me a Polaroid picture of Rebecca, just like Tina the week before, and..."
His hoarse voice disappears, but his mouth keeps moving for a while until it stops. He leans his big head to one side and looks straight through Eric with empty eyes. "I didn't hear what you said."
"It's my fault. I should pluck out my eye, for it has offended me. It would be better to pluck my eye out than this."
Rocky tries to stand up, but Eric holds him down with a gentle hand on his shoulder, and feels the big body vibrate, trembling with fear. "You're in a state of deep relaxation," Eric says, as sweat trickles down his back. "But before you wake up, I want you to look straight at the preacher and tell me what you see."
"I'm lying on the floor. I can see boots. I can smell blood. And I shut my eyes."
"Go back a little."
"I can't do any more,"
Rocky says, and starts to come round from his hypnosis. "Stay there just for a moment. There's no danger. You're relaxed. You're telling me about the first time you saw the unclean preacher."
"It's in the church."
He opens his eyes for a moment, then shuts them again and mutters something inaudible. "Tell me about the church," Eric says. "What's happening?"
"I don't know," Rocky gasps. "It's not a sermon."
"What can you see?"
"He's wearing makeup over his stubble, and his arms are so fucking riddled with holes that..."
Rocky tries to stand up, but his chair falls over and he collapses and hits the back of his head on the floor. Chapter 61. Rocky rolls onto his side and Eric helps him to his feet. He stretches his back, rubs his mouth with his hand, pushes Eric away and goes over to the window, looking through the gaps between the vertical bars. Do you remember anything from when you were hypnotized? Eric asks, picking the chair up off the floor. Rocky turns round and looks at him through narrowed eyes.
Was I entertaining?
You talked a lot about the preacher. You do know what his real name is, don't you? Rocky purses his lips and slowly shakes his head.
No.
I think you do, and I don't understand why you're protecting him.
The preacher is just a scapegoat.
Give me a name, then, Eric persists.
I can't remember, Rocky says.
A place, then. Where is he? Where's the zone? Sunlight from behind shines through his beard onto his furrowed cheeks.
Was this the first time you've hypnotized me?
Rocky asks. I've never hypnotized you before.
As far as I'm concerned, the evaluation was a waste of time,
Rocky says without listening.
But I liked talking to you. You remember that? It's almost 10 years ago. I remember your brown cord jacket. That must have been pretty damn retro, even then. We used to sit on opposite sides of a table, chipboard with a birch veneer, you can tell by the smell. Paper cups of water, dictaphone, notebook, and my head was really hurting again. I needed morphine, but I wanted to tell you about my alibi first.
I don't remember that, Eric says, taking a step back. Rocky picks at the window between the bars.
I wrote down Olivia's address, but that was never mentioned in court.
But you confessed to murdering.
Just tell me what happened to my alibi, he interrupts.
I didn't really take it seriously. Rocky turns round, walks closer, hunches up slightly, and lowers his head, as if to see Eric better.
So you never mentioned it to my defense lawyer?
Eric glances quickly over his shoulder and can see that the guard outside the door has disappeared. Rocky shoves the chairs between them out of the way with his foot.
I don't remember being given an address, Eric says quickly. But if I was, I'm sure I would have handed it to your defense team.
You threw it away, didn't you?
Rocky says darkly and steps closer. Calm down, Eric replies, moving towards the door.
You sentenced me to this, Rocky shouts. It was you. You were the one who did this to me.
Eric is standing with his back to the door and raises his hands to hold Rocky back, but he doesn't stand a chance of defending himself. Rocky just brushes his arms aside and punches him in the chest with his fist. The blow feels like a sledgehammer. All the air goes out of his lungs and he can't breathe. The next punch strikes exactly the same place, and Eric's head slams back against the door with a dull thud. He is struggling to stay upright. The zip on his jacket catches on the textured wallpaper as he moves sideways to get away. He raises a hand to fend Rocky off, coughs, and tries to breathe.
Do you want me to look into your alibi?
He hisses.
Liar!
Rocky roars, grabbing Eric by the chin and pressing his mouth closed. Rocky pulls him towards him and slaps the side of his head so hard that his vision goes black. Eric staggers to one side with the force of the blow, falls over the plastic chair, and careers into the metal bed frame with a force that makes his back creak. He pulls the covers off the bed as he slides down onto the floor, his cheek burning.
That's enough now,
Eric gasps, shuffling backwards.
Shut up!
Rocky yells and shoves the plastic chair aside. As he leans forward, Eric kicks out at him and hits him in the chest. Rocky catches hold of his foot, and Eric kicks out with the other one. His shoe comes off, and Rocky stumbles back, just as the guard comes in holding a taser.
Stand against the wall, Rocky. Hands behind your head, feet wide apart.
Eric gets slowly to his feet and adjusts his clothes. He picks up the covers from the floor with trembling hands and puts them back on the bed.
"It might look a bit odd," he gasps, tasting blood in his mouth. "But I had cramp in my leg and Rocky was helping me take my shoes off."
The guard stares at him.
"Cramp? It feels better already."
Rocky is standing quietly to the side with his fingers laced behind his neck. The back of his white vest is wet with sweat.
"What have you got to say, Rocky?"
He lowers his hands and turns round slowly, scratches his beard, and nods.
"I was helping the doctor with his shoe," he says gruffly.
"We did shout, but no one heard," Eric explains. "I tried lying down on the bed, but slipped off onto the floor."
"Is it feeling better now?"
Rocky asks, picking Eric's shoe up from the floor.
"Much better, thanks."
The guard stands there with the taser in his hand, looks at them, then nods, although something obviously isn't right.
"The visit's over," the guard says.
"If you can just tell me Olivia's surname, I can find her," Eric says, meeting Rocky's gaze. "Her name is Olivia Turaby," he says simply.
Eric leaves with the guard, follows him along the corridor, and sees that Casillas is talking to the head of section in the day room.
"Did it go okay?"
Casillas calls. Eric stops in the doorway, his cheeks still stinging from the force of the blow.
"I have to say, you've done a remarkable job with the patient," he replies. "Thanks," Casillas smiles. "I'm pretty sure he'd have been released if he'd applied for parole, but he doesn't seem to think he's done his penance yet."
Eric limps towards his car, gets out his phone, and dials Margot's number to tell her about Olivia Turaby. Chapter 62. Yuna opens his eyes and looks up at the white ceiling. Daylight is filtering into the room around the edges of the dark blue roller blind. The window is open slightly and fresh air is streaming in, cooling the clean sheets. There are blackbirds singing in the garden. He looks at the alarm clock and sees that he has slept for 13 hours. Eric has left him a phone, and on the bedside table are 2 pink capsules and 3 tablets on top of a note saying, "Eat us now, drink loads of water, and have a look in the fridge." Yuna swallows the drugs, empties the glass of water, then groans as he stands up. But he can at least bear to put some weight on his leg. The pain is still there, but it's far from severe. The nausea and pain in his stomach have vanished as though they never existed. He goes over to the window and looks out at the apple trees as he dials Lumi's number.
"It's Dad," Yuna says, feeling his heart tighten.
"Dad?
How are you getting on? Do you like Paris?"
"It's a bit bigger than Natavara," his daughter replies in a voice that could be Suma's.
"How's college?"
"I'm still finding it confusing, but I think it's pretty good."
Yuna reassures himself that she's got everything she needs, and Lumi tells him to shave off his beard and join the police again. And then they end the call. Eric has left him a pair of black sweatpants and a white t-shirt. The clothes are too small. The trousers flutter around his calves, and the t-shirt is tight across his chest. By the bed is a pair of white slippers, the sort you get in hotels. Yuna thinks that mysteries are only mysteries until you have discounted all the impossibilities. When he was in hospital, Margot told him that the videos had been recorded long before the murders took place. Maria Carlson owned nothing but black underwear, but the seams of the tights she was wearing when she died were different to the ones in the video. The spoon found in the tub of ice cream in Susanna Kern's home wasn't the same one that was in the video, and the post-mortem will probably show that Sandra Lundgren hadn't injected herself with insulin in her thigh on the day she was murdered. Classic stalking. The women have been watched and their behavior mapped over a long period. Yuna leans against the walls as he walks through the house towards the kitchen. He tells himself that he'll call the police in Huddinge and follow up the previous day's events as soon as he's had something to eat. He drinks some more water, puts coffee on, and looks in the fridge, where he finds half a pizza and a tub of yogurt. On the kitchen table, next to Eric's empty coffee cup, are printouts relating to an almost 10-year-old case that was tried in Södertälje District Court. Yuna eats the cold pizza as he reads the verdict, the post-mortem analysis, and the entire preliminary investigation report. The old murder has striking similarities to the recent ones. The vicar of the parish of Salem, Rocky Kirklund, was arrested and convicted for the murder of a woman called Rebecca Hansson. Yuna was pretty out of it yesterday when Eric was taking care of him, but he can remember what Eric said. Margot Silverman had asked him to go and talk to a guy who had been sentenced to secure psychiatric care. She wanted Eric to find out if he had any accomplices or disciples. She must have meant Rocky Kirklund. Margot's thinking along the right lines, Yuna thinks, bracing his arms on the table as he stands up again. He walks barefoot into the back garden, sits down on the cushionless garden swing for a while, then walks over to the shed. On one end is a water-damaged dartboard. Yuna opens the door and gets out the cushions for the swing seat. He goes back to the shed to close the door, but stops and looks at the neat arrangement of DIY tools and gardening implements on the wall. In the turning circle at the end of the road, an ice cream van starts to play its jingle. Yuna picks up an old Mura knife with a red wooden handle and tests its weight, then takes down a smaller knife in a plastic sleeve, walks out, and shuts the door behind him. He puts the smaller knife on the ground beside the swing seat, then stands in the middle of the lawn and weighs the Mura knife in his right hand. He changes his grip, tries to find some sort of balance, a sense of lightness, puts the knife down by his hip and stretches out the other arm, feeling it tug at his wound. Cautiously, he tries to perform a kata against two opponents with the knife. He doesn't follow through on all the elements, but his legs still feel frustratingly heavy when he finishes. Yuna twists his body and moves his legs in the reverse order, leaving his attacker's torso unguarded. He performs a diagonal cut, starting at the bottom, blocks the second attacker's hand, and diverts the force of the assault as the knife moves downward, then glides out of danger. He repeats the pattern of movements, slowly, perfectly balanced. His hip hurts, but his level of concentration is the same as before. The different elements of the kata are only complicated because they don't come naturally. But against untrained opponents, they can be extremely effective. In 9 coordinated movements, the attackers are disarmed and rendered harmless. It works like a trap. If anyone chooses to attack, the trap is sprung. Katas and shadow boxing can never replace sparring and real-life situations, but they're a way to get the body used to the movements, and by repetition, train the body to think that certain movements belong together. Yuna rolls his shoulders, finds his balance, hits out a few times, follows through with his elbow, then repeats the kata, but faster this time. He performs the vertical cut, deflects the imaginary attack, changes grip, but drops the knife in the grass. He stops and straightens his back, listens to the bird song and the wind in the trees. He takes some deep breaths, bends over, picks up the knife and blows some grass off it, and finds its center of gravity. Then he takes the knife in his right hand, throws it past the hammock at the dartboard, which wobbles, and the old darts come loose and fall off into the grass. Someone claps, and he turns round and sees a woman in the garden. She's tall and blonde, and is watching him with a calm smile on her face. Chapter 63. The woman looking at Yuna has a self-aware but relaxed posture, reminiscent of a mannequin. Her arms are slender and her hands very freckly. She's wearing makeup, but not too much. Tasteful. It looks like she might be blushing slightly. Yuna bends down and picks up the second knife from the ground, weighs it in his hand, then throws it over his shoulder towards the dartboard. It ends up in the branches of the weeping birch and falls to the grass next to the shed. She claps her hands again and walks over to him, smiling.
"Yuna Lina?" she asks.
"It's not easy to see with a beard like this, but I think so," he replies.
"Eric said you were confined to bed, and..."
The veranda door opens, and Eric comes out into the garden with a worried look on his face.
"You should be careful with that hip until we've had it x-rayed," he says.
"It's fine," Yuna says.
"I gave him cortisone in..."
"So you said," the smiling woman interrupts. "It seems to have worked."
"This is Nelly," Eric says. "She's my closest colleague, an excellent psychologist, the best in the country for traumatized children."
"That's all empty flattery,"
she smiles, shaking Yuna's hand.
"How do you feel?" Eric asks.
"Fine,"
he replies quietly. "The penicillin will kick in properly tomorrow. You'll feel much stronger," Eric says, smiling at Yuna's tight clothes. Yuna groans as he sits down on the swing seat. The others sit down beside him, and they swing together, gently. The springs creak, and the cushions give off a damp, musty smell.
"Did you read the report of the preliminary investigation?" Eric asks after a while.
"Yes,"
Yuna says, glancing at him.
"I went and talked to Rocky this morning. He's had terrible problems with his memory since the accident, but he was willing to try hypnosis."
"You hypnotized him?"
Yuna asks with interest.
"I wasn't sure if it would work, given the damage to brain tissue and his epileptic attacks."
"But he was receptive?"
Yuna asks, leaning his head back and looking up at the sky.
"Yes, but it wasn't easy working out what were real memories. Rocky used to take a lot of drugs in those days, and some of the things he said under hypnosis, which ought to have been proper memories, sounded more like nightmares, delirium."
"God, that's difficult,"
Nelly said, stretching her ankles. Eric stands up, making the swing seat move again.
"I was really only going to ask about the murder of Rebecca Hanson to find out if he had an accomplice," he says. "But under hypnosis, it sounded more like he was completely innocent."
"In what way?"
Yuna asks. "Rocky keeps returning to a man he calls the preacher, the unclean preacher."
"That sounds creepy,"
Nelly says.
"And now, all of a sudden, he remembers that he's got an alibi for the night of the murder,"
Eric says in a low voice.
"He said that under hypnosis?"
Yuna asks. "No, he was awake then."
"Is there anyone who can confirm the alibi?"
"Her name is Olivia Turibi. He remembered it at the time, but he's probably already forgotten it again," Eric says, looking away.
"An alibi?" Nelly says.
"It's worth checking out anyway," Eric says.
Have you spoken to Margot about this? Yuna asks.
Of course.
Psychologists lead 1-0, Nelly says, slapping the cushion beside her to get him to sit down again. Eric does so, and they spend a little while swinging, drifting off to the sound of the slow creaking of the metal springs, the bird song, and some children playing in a nearby garden. Then Eric's mobile buzzes on the cushion. It's Margot, and Yuna takes the call.
I presume you've checked criminal records, any previous suspicions, and the police database.
Good to hear that you're feeling better, Margot's rough voice says.
The murderer may have done time, or simply been out of the country for all these years, Yuna goes on. I've got pretty good contacts with Europol, and
Yuna, I can't discuss the preliminary investigation with you, she interrupts.
No, but I was just trying to say that 9 years is one hell of a long cooling off period for...
Okay, now I understand. I understand what you mean, but Rocky Sherklund's alibi doesn't stand up.
You found her?
Olivia Tureby had no idea what we were talking about. She was living in Jönköping at the time, and we can't see any connection between her and Rocky Sherklund.
So you still think he had an apprentice? That he's mixed up in the murders?
That's why I'm calling Eric, Margot says calmly. I want him to go back and ask Rocky properly about accomplices.
I'll pass you over to him, Yuna says, and hands over the phone.
While Eric is talking to Margot, Yuna goes and picks up the knives and puts them back in the shed. He rests against the handle of a lawnmower for a moment. There's a small wasp's nest up by the roof, and in the far corner, a homemade toy truck behind some folding chairs. When he comes out again, Eric is no longer on the phone and has stretched out next to Nelly.
Do you normally phone witnesses to ask about alibis? Eric asks him.
It depends, Yuna replies.
I just mean, you don't know if people are prepared to get involved, Eric says.
You don't know if people tell the truth when the police phone them so many years later.
No, Yuna says.
I need to talk to her if I'm going to be able to go back to Rocky and look him in the eye, Eric says.
Chapter 64.
Yuna wanted to go with Eric to talk to Olivia Tureby, but accepted that it was too soon. Eric gave him some more penicillin, another